The sound of barking dogs startled 53-year-old Sandra Melgar awake. She struggled to make sense of her surroundings as she lay on the floor of her bathroom closet. Her muscles ached. Her head throbbed. Her underwear was soiled. She tried to move, but noticed her hands were bound behind her back. Her feet were also tied together. She tried to roll over and get to the door, but her bindings were too tight, and two previous hip replacements hampered her movement. Even if she were able, there was a chair propped against the door from the outside. Not far away in a bedroom closet, Sandra's husband of 32 years, Jim Melgar, lay dead with 31 knife wounds across his hands and chest. Blood stained the white walls, carpet, Jim's clothes, and a briefcase that lay nearby. There was a blood smear on a safe next to Jim's body. His feet were bound by a gray telephone cord. A loaded gun was up on a closet shelf that police would later determine hadn't been touched. Dresser drawers in the bedroom were ransacked with clothes, books, and pill bottles strewn across the floor. The contents of Sandra's purse and wallet had been thrown across the top of a white comforter that was stained with speckles of blood. A white stool sitting in front of the bed was also stained with a blood pattern that resembled a knife blade. Next to the bench, the back of a wooden chair was coated in red. In a partially filled jacuzzi bathtub, where Sandra and Jim had spent the previous evening, there was a white blouse, a green towel, and a silver chef knife with a 6-inch blade that rested under the water, a knife that investigators would later determine was the murder weapon, taken from inside the Melgar's home. Sandra and Jim spent the previous night celebrating their 32nd wedding anniversary. The two ate dinner at their favorite Mexican restaurant and continued their celebration in their jacuzzi with candles, cocktails, strawberries, and whipped cream. In the jacuzzi, the two spoke about their years together and plans for the future. They wanted to sell their home and travel the world, visit the Grand Canyon, Ireland, and to see the Northern Lights. Jim planned on retiring from his job as a computer programmer with the Houston Independent School District. They discussed buying a beach house where they planned to settle down once they finished traveling. After 2 hours, by Sandra's later estimations, they heard their dogs barking in the backyard. Jim grabbed a towel, slipped on Sandra's house shoes, and walked out of the bathroom to let them in. That was the last time Sandra says she saw her husband alive. She says she woke up some 15 hours later, tied up in her closet, with no signs of Jim. Again, she heard the dogs barking, but this time there were voices coming from inside her home. She screamed. This is Jillian, and in partnership with the Law and Crime Trial Network, you are listening to Court Junkie, episode 144. One of my favorite podcasts is Canadian True Crime with Christy Lee. She covers the most fascinating cases based out of Canada, and it's a fantastic listen. Stay tuned to the end of this episode for a trailer about the podcast. Make taking better care of your health a priority, and make it super easy with Carev. Carev is a wellness brand that makes it easy to maintain your health goals by creating a customized vitamin plan that helps you feel your best today and supports you long-term. Here's how it works. You go to their website, takecareof.com, and take an in-depth but short 5-minute quiz about your diet, lifestyle, and health concerns. Questions I answered included, how much sleep do I get, and how often do I work out? It's like getting a one-on-one consultation with a nutritionist, all without leaving your house. Carev then recommends a list of vitamins and supplements specifically tailored just for you, and you can follow their recommendations or adjust what you receive at any time. Then you get a customized box at your door with daily packs that are super easy and convenient, especially if you're always on the go. All of Care/of's products are formulated with good-for-you, clean ingredients that are backed by science. In my packs, I get these really great protein powders that are made of ingredients you can actually recognize. Court junkies can get 50% off your first Care/of order. Go to takecareof.com and enter code JUNKIE50. That's takecareof.com and enter the code JUNKIE50. Take coloring your hair at home to the next level with Madison Reed. Now, you might be wondering how you're going to find the right color, and then what about the cost? Well, Madison Reed makes coloring your hair at home affordable, and they give you the tools you need to make it easy to choose your perfect color. For just $22, Madison Reed gives you beautiful, professional hair color delivered right to your door. And Madison Reed's color is unique. It's crafted by master colorists who blend nuances of light, dark, cool, and warm tones to create over 55 gorgeous multidimensional shades. To find your perfect shade, you just go to their website, madison-reed.com, and take their quick online quiz that will ask you some simple questions about your hair and your goals. So do your hair coloring at home and look as if you just came from the salon. Now, Court Junkies can get 10% off plus free shipping on their first color kit with the code COURT. Go to madison-reed.com and use the code COURT. That's madison-reed.com and use the code COURT. It was December 23rd, 2012. Herman Melgar stood outside his brother's home just after 4:30 in the afternoon, questioning why no one was answering the door. Jim had invited Herman and his family over for dinner days before, but now no one was answering, which Herman found odd. Jim's black truck was parked in the driveway, and an open garage door showed Sandra's car parked inside. Herman told his family to wait at the door while he walked around to the backyard. Always the handyman, Jim spent a lot of his time busy with projects around the house. Herman peeked over the fence but saw no signs of Jim or Sandra. He walked back to the front and decided to try the laundry room door inside the garage. To his surprise, it was unlocked. He let himself into the dark and stuffy house. Jim and Sandra's dogs barked and jumped as Herman walked in and made his way to the front door to let his family inside. That's when they heard muffled screams. Herman ran to the back of the house and found a large chair propped against the door to the bathroom closet. Inside, Sandra was lying on the floor in a black satin robe, screaming for help. Herman and his wife Maria tried to remove the bindings around Sandra's arms and legs, but they were too tight, and Herman had to use a pair of scissors to cut her loose. She had bruises on her arms, including a dark bruise on her bicep. She cried, "Where's Jim?" Once free, she walked into her bedroom and saw Jim's feet sticking out of the closet. She ran and checked his pulse, but it was obvious by his pale, cold, naked body that he was dead. Sandra covered him with a jacket before Maria led her back to the bathroom. Jim and Sandra first met at Houston's Lamar High School. Jim was smitten by the 17-year-old girl with blue eyes and blonde hair, who just so happened to sit in front of him in class. Sandra was the new girl at school after she moved to Houston from the border town of Laredo. He did things like pull her hair to try to get her attention, but she continued to decline his advances. Jim never gave up. One day, he invited her to join him and a group of friends to go ice skating. Sandra didn't see the harm in meeting him with a group of people. But Jim had set the whole thing up. When Sandra arrived, it was just Jim and his best friend, who mysteriously disappeared shortly after she arrived. Jim, with his shaggy black hair and awkward teenage mustache, used his charm and terrible jokes that later in life became known as Jim jokes to charm Sandra. Sandra loved that he was smart and funny and thoughtful. He loved that she was down to earth and wasn't stuck up. Before long, they were inseparable. And 2 years after high school graduation, they got married in a courthouse in downtown Houston. Sandra was crying hysterically when paramedics arrived. One of the first paramedics on scene, Stephanie Roberts, noted in her report that Sandra, quote, remained in a state of shock and had periods of crying, and that she had no sense of time and last recalls a time of about 1 a.m. this morning. Roberts wrote that Sandra didn't realize that approximately 15 hours had passed since she blacked out in the closet. Once police arrived, they took pictures of Sandra's arm and hands. They noted a bruise on her bicep and a scratch on her left thumb. They didn't notice any blood. Sandra told police she could only recall waking up in her bathroom closet and that she might have suffered a seizure, but she wasn't certain. As crime scene investigators collected evidence throughout the house, Sandra was taken to an interrogation room at the Harris County Sheriff's Office. White walls and tall ceilings surrounded the small boxed room. Sandra sat in a wooden chair in the corner of the room between Sheriff Sergeants Sean Carrizal and James Ducey. Sandra's hair rested on her shoulders and covered her black robe. She wore blue jeans and striped socks with no shoes. Her cane was leaning against an arm of her chair. Two glasses of water sat on a small table next to her. She told the detectives it was too cold.
Where were you at? Let's start from the morning when you woke up today. Where were you at? Yes.
In my closet.
This morning?
Yes.
Okay, what about yesterday? Let's start yesterday.
Yesterday.
Which would be Saturday.
We went out to eat.
Okay, where'd y'all go eat at?
Mexican restaurant. I think it was Don Bravos.
And what town was that?
No, it wasn't Don Bravos. It was Cucos. I'm missing about 8. I mean, I'm just guessing. I don't know.
Okay, so approximately 8 o'clock.
Mm-hmm.
Sandra led the detectives through the night before. She and Jim ate dinner at their favorite Mexican restaurant, Los Cucos. They stopped at a CVS on the way home to pick up mixers for their drinks. She noted that after they left, they noticed a car that appeared to be tailgating them and following them into their neighborhood. Jim started to drive slower, and she told him not to do that because it's dangerous. But the car turned left while they turned right, so they thought it was just a coincidence. Sandra was soft-spoken during the interview, and she told them the side of her head hurt. With some details, she was very specific. Like she took her boots off in the bedroom, undressed in the bathroom, and recalled what she and Jim talked about in the jacuzzi. With other details, she struggled to remember. She was unsure what time they got home, at first saying around midnight, before guessing around 10:30 or 11. A receipt from the CVS shows Jim bought a 2-liter of Coke and a 2-liter of Sprite at 9:33. Their home is about a 5-minute drive from there. She told the detectives that Jim was out of the bath for about 15 minutes to let the dogs in, but later said it was probably about 5 minutes.
So y'all were sitting there talking for a couple hours, and what happened?
He got out once to go get ice and then came back and then said he was going to move the dogs because they were barking too much.
What was he wearing?
A towel.
Okay.
That was it.
So he went and got ice and you say, move the dogs.
I think he took my fuzzy shoes. I'm not sure.
Okay. And how long was that during the time y'all were there? Y'all sat there for a good solid 2 hours talking?
Yeah.
And he didn't move?
He went out once to get ice.
Where to get ice? In the kitchen? Uh-huh. And he comes back?
Mm-hmm. I got out, I went to the bathroom, got back in.
There inside that bathroom? Okay.
Sandra said after he got out to let the dogs in, she remembered him taking a while. This was around 1 or 2 in the morning, she said.
And he just, you know, was taking a while, so I got out and was going to get dressed or change in my closet. And I went in there and I started to change. And that's all I remember until I woke up. And then I remember I woke up and I thought I had a seizure because my muscles hurt and my head was just hurting real bad. And usually lately I've been having trouble with controlling my seizures. So I dozed off again. I just fell asleep again. Until several hours later, I woke up and realized I was tied up. And I tried to flip over because my left side was asleep. I'd fallen asleep. I tried to flip over and then I kind of got stuck where I was for the rest of the time. That's all I remember. That's it. I mean, I would tell you more if I remembered more. I just don't.
When asked about pain, Sandra said she has pain in her head, like she got hit on the head or fell or was pushed. She was asked if she heard any noises while Jim was gone, and she said the jacuzzi was still running, that it was pretty loud. She said in order to get the dogs inside, Jim would usually just call them and they would come in through the doggy door. Sometimes they would have to open the door if the little ones didn't want to come in. Doucet asked her if she would have heard the door opening, and she said no, she wouldn't have. For more than 3 hours, Sandra sat in the interrogation room as the detectives peppered her with questions. They asked her to take a lie detector test, but she declined. She said she was too nervous and that she was shaking and cold. She didn't want the test used against her. Her refusal irked the detectives, who seemed to take it as she was hiding something.
But she didn't hear any noises. So it's really important that you try to recall. I mean, like my partner said, you know, we're not sitting there trying to talk bad about you. It's just that you're the only thing, you're the only one we had to talk to that was there when whatever happened, happened. Okay? And that's why it's so important, you know, for you to try to recall.
I wish I could recall. My memory is so bad.
Doucet asked her if she believed she had been sexually assaulted or violated in any way. She said no, she thinks she would know. Sandra told the detectives she believed she had a seizure when she was in the closet. She said she believed she woke up at one point, but must have fallen back asleep because of the seizure. Sandra had a long history of health issues. She suffered from lupus, rheumatoid arthritis, and grand mal seizures. Those seizures often lead a person to have violent contractions and can lead to a loss of consciousness. She said it's common that when she has a seizure, that she'll sleep for hours and often wake up confused and disoriented. She can also feel them coming on. Sandra told the detectives that in the weeks before Jim died, she had been having auras, a symptom she described as a warning that a seizure was coming.
How often do you have seizures like that?
I've been getting them more lately. I'm not able to drive anymore.
How frequent?
At least once a month, maybe. The auras, I get them all the time.
Do you take medication for that? Okay. And when was the last time that you had one of those before today?
I about a month ago at home.
And what happens when you have those seizures? Do you, what's the symptoms? Well, how do you feel when you have those?
Oh, I have auras, signs that tell me that I'm going to have one. And it's like very forgetful, more than usual.
Did you have one of those today?
Yeah, I've been having it all week, actually all month.
So have you been forgetting things all month?
Mm-hmm.
And do you ever recall what you've forgotten later on?
Some things. Some things I don't. Before and right after, sometimes I can't even tell you my name.
As the interview continued, the detective's frustrations became clear. Sandra's story, they felt, wasn't adding up. They questioned if she and Jim were having any problems in their marriage. No, Sandra told them. Sandra said that Jim was planning a trip to San Antonio to visit his family without her, which the detectives found odd. Doucet pressed her again if they weren't getting along. No, we all got along, she told him. Sometimes he does that if he wants to. They questioned how she was in the house when her husband died, but heard nothing. They began to focus on her as the likely killer and started aggressively questioning her, as though they were trying to get her to confess to the killing.
You know, something I want you to understand is that what we do when we investigate something like this, Sandra, I want you to understand that we go to all extremes.
Mm-hmm.
You know, we don't quit. You're going to see a lot of me. You're going to see a lot of my partner.
Okay.
You are. We're going to find out everything about you. We're going to find out everything about your husband. We're going to talk to everybody in your neighborhood. We're going to talk to everybody that you're related to. We're going to learn everything.
What do you think should happen to the person that if we catch that did this to your husband? What do you think his punishment or her punishment should be? Do you think they should get a second chance?
No.
What do you think should happen to him or her?
They should go to prison. Isn't that what they normally do? They go to prison?
Burglary and then homicide be construed as a capital murder could be death penalty. Think they should get the death penalty?
Yeah. Yeah. I have no problem with the death penalty. I think it serves a purpose.
Sandra was asked if her husband was abusive towards her, and she said no, they got along just fine. Ask all my friends. We got along great, she said.
Did you stage that at your house, ma'am?
Stage it?
Yeah. Did you plan this?
No. No, I did not.
Would you tell me if you did?
I wouldn't even know where to start to stage it. And how am I going to tie myself up like that and not even be able to get out of it? I mean, I really was trying to get out of it.
Doucet asked her if she was tied up the first time she woke up. She said she doesn't know, that she's been trying to remember that. The second time, she said she could tell she was more awake. They again asked her if she heard anything, like her husband yelling. She said no. Carrizal pointed out that the wounds her husband had were painful. He went through a lot of pain, he said. He suffered a lot.
He was right there. That's less than 20, 25 feet from where you were at.
The only thing I can think of is that I was already out when that happened. That's the only thing I can think of.
Well, isn't it ironic that you black out at the exact time when he's getting stabbed and bludgeoned
I don't have an answer for you.
Multiple times like that. Dying, screaming for help.
Oh my gosh. Just,
I don't understand that. That's ironic to me.
It's a lot of blood that he lost.
And then whatever he encountered them before you did, before they came and knocked you out. That's why I think there was ample opportunity for you to hear something and nothing. You're saying nothing. I mean, you could have had an army tank running in that bathroom and you'd hear that. That's what I don't understand.
Sandra insisted that she didn't hear anything.
I need you to help me on this. Can you help me? I need you to help me. Sandra, can you help me?
I didn't hear anything.
I need help, Sandra. Please help me. Screaming after screaming after screaming, he's in pain. I need help. Tell me. Your husband's a nice guy. He went through a lot of pain. Help me.
Carrizal continued, repeatedly saying, "Help me, Sandra. I need help.
Sandra, I need help.
I didn't hear anything. Just stop already.
I need help, Sandra. I need help. Help me.
That's it. I need a lawyer. I'm not talking anymore because you guys are just trying to torture me here.
I'm not torturing you. I'm asking for help.
Do you love your husband?
Yes, I love my husband.
Do you care about him?
Yes.
Do you want us to finally kill him?
Of course.
I don't think you do.
Did you kill your husband?
No, I didn't.
Did you have anything to do with your husband's death?
No.
The detectives walked out of the room, leaving Sandra crying with her face buried in her hands. She was later given a ride home. That night, Carrizal called the Harris County District Attorney's Office to file murder charges. But the DA's office declined due to a lack of evidence. Make your mark in the new year with comfortable, washable, and sustainable shoes and bags from Rothy's. Rothy's come in an ever-changing array of colors, prints, and patterns, and are available in a range of styles. One of my favorite pair of shoes is from Rothy's, and I get compliments on them pretty much every time I wear them. I have the Chelsea in Berry Lattice Stitch, and not only are they cute, but they're comfortable and machine washable. Rothy's makes shoes and accessories out of plastic water bottles. To date, they have transformed over 70 million bottles into beautiful shoes, handbags, and face masks. Vogue calls Rothy's a personal obsession, and Health says they're the most comfortable shoes on earth. Plus, Rothy's come with free shipping and free returns on eligible items, so you can gift without worry. Check out all the amazing shoes, bags, and masks available right now at rothys.com/court. That's rothys.com, rothys.com/court. Style and sustainability meet to create your new favorites. Head on over to rothys.com/court today. It's February, which means that if you're coupled up, you're probably wondering how to make Valentine's Day special this year. Whether you're spending every moment with your partner or taking this quarantine time to work on yourself before jumping into a relationship, it's important to seek out a therapist to help you set and accomplish your goals so you can emerge from quarantine stronger than ever. Talkspace lets you send and receive unlimited messages with your dedicated therapist in the Talkspace platform 24/7. With Talkspace, you set goals with your therapist and they hold you accountable and make sure you're really progressing. Therapy can really help you shift your perspective, find tools to cope in difficult times, and really be a guiding light. Talkspace has thousands of licensed therapists with years of experience in over 40 specialties, including depression, anxiety, substance abuse, relationship issues, and so much more. And it's a fraction of the cost of in-person therapy. As a listener of this podcast, you'll get $100 off your first month with Talkspace. To match with a licensed therapist today, go to Talkspace.com or download the app. Make sure to use the code COURT to get $100 off of your first month and show your support for the show. That's Talkspace.com and use the code COURT. 2 days after the murder, Sandra and Jim's daughter, Liz, met with the detectives. Liz had scoped out the house and pointed to things that were missing, including various bottles of her mother's medicine. She told them about a backpack she found in the garage with a gaming system inside. She stressed to them Sandra's health problems. But nothing came from her tips. Liz made follow-up calls to the detectives, alerting them to damage done to her parents' rental homes caused by angry tenants. But she and Sandra weren't given any information about the investigation. Months passed, a year. And then, a year and a half after Jim's death, in July 2014, Sandra was indicted by a grand jury for Jim's murder. In Texas, grand jury proceedings are kept secret, so it's impossible to know what evidence was presented. Liz only found out about the charges when she checked the mail and found letters from various attorneys inquiring about representing Sandra in her upcoming criminal case. Even after Sandra was formally indicted, her case moved slowly. It passed through four different prosecutors with the Harris County District Attorney's Office before it found its way to Colleen Barnett. Barnett has tried more than 70 murder cases in her 24-year career. When she reviewed Sandra's case, Barnett admitted it was a difficult case to prove. There was no direct evidence linking Sandra to the crime. Sandra never confessed, and there was no clear motive why Sandra would kill her husband. Nearly 5 years after Jim's death, in August 2017, Sandra stood trial for Jim's murder. Barnett told the jury that Sandra had been planning Jim's murder and then killed him on the night they celebrated their 32nd anniversary. She walked them through how she believed Sandra lured Jim into the bedroom with the promise of having sex, pointing to a bag of sex toys found near the bed. She said Sandra sat him in a chair next to the bed and began massaging him before she took a knife from their kitchen and cut him from his chest to his neck. She then kept stabbing him until he fell back in his closet, hitting his head, cracking his skull, and fell to the floor where he died. Barnett told the jury that Sandra had 14 hours to stage a home invasion, clean up, and lock herself in the closet. Barnett said Sandra emptied her purse on the bed, including her wallet. She opened dresser drawers and scattered items around to make it appear the room had been ransacked. Barnett told the jury that Sandra cleaned herself off and disposed of her bloody clothes. For her last act, Barnett said Sandra was able to lock herself in her bathroom closet using a bath mat to pull a chair under the door handle to make it look as if someone had locked her in there. She then wrapped bindings around her arms and ankles to make it appear as if she had been tied up. And then she waited until the next day for Jim's family to arrive for dinner. The medical examiner who conducted Jim's autopsy, Dr. Catherine Pineri, testified that Jim was struck at least 50 times, including 31 sharp force injuries, likely caused from a knife. Jim had a skull fracture and multiple blunt force injuries to his head and face. Dr. Pineri said she believed the fracture was caused when Jim fell backwards in his closet and hit his head on the bar holding his clothes. Jim had deep stab wounds across his torso that pierced the pericardial sac around his heart, another that cut into his liver and caused bleeding in his abdomen. A 3-inch wound cut between his ribs and pierced his chest cavity. Jim also had injuries on his hands that Dr. Pineri said were consistent with defensive wounds that showed Jim tried to fight back and protect himself. A deep cut between his right thumb and index finger likely severed a blood vessel that led to a lot of bleeding. As for ligature marks or hemorrhages from the telephone cord that had been tied around Jim's ankles, she said she didn't find any, which she would have expected to see if he had been alive while tied up. Since there were no such injuries, she opined that the cords had been tied around his ankles after he was already dead. Dr. Panieri told the jury it was a very bloody scene, adding she expected the person who killed him to have a lot of blood on them too. The crime, she concluded, likely happened inside the closet due to the amount of blood found inside. She told the jury Jim died due to multiple sharp force injuries and blunt force trauma. She couldn't identify a single wound that caused his death. Barnett conceded to the jury that the case against Sandra was circumstantial and that there was no direct evidence linking her to the crime. Jim's blood wasn't found on Sandra, nor was her DNA found on the bloody knife or the clothes found in the partially filled bathtub. Photos taken of Sandra's hands after police arrived showed no injuries or signs she was involved in an attack. And though Barnett acknowledged there was no obvious motive, she threw out various theories. Sandra wanted to cash in on Jim's life insurance policy from work. Or perhaps it was because Sandra wanted out of their marriage, but their religion as Jehovah's Witnesses doesn't allow for divorce. During an in-court demonstration, the prosecution showed how Sandra could have tied herself up. They then played a video showing how she could have locked herself inside the bathroom closet. One of the Melgars' neighbors was called to testify, saying she did not hear the Melgars' dogs barking that night, and that in the past, they had often woken her up. The prosecution also brought in Sandra's medical records from her primary care physician. The records did confirm that she had been diagnosed with a seizure disorder 30 years earlier, but they also showed that her condition was currently stable. Just a few months before and after the murder, the physician reported that Sandra had not had any seizure episodes. Sandra's neurologist testified that Sandra came to see him a few months after Jim's murder, the first time in about 10 years that she had done so. His report stated that Sandra had complained of a recent seizure, but that before that, she had not had one in about a year. While the prosecution rested their case solely on Sandra as the killer, Sandra's defense attorney, George Mack Seacrest, said she was nothing more than a victim of a deadly home invasion who was assaulted and tied up in her bathroom closet before the intruders then killed her husband. Seacrest told the jury that investigators quickly honed in on Sandra as their lone suspect and ignored the evidence of a home invasion. The intruders could have attacked Jim when he went in the backyard to let in the couple's barking dogs. The intruders likely then fled through the garage door, which would explain why the door was open when Jim's family arrived the next day. Seacrest told the jury that there were multiple things stolen from the house, including a laptop, a TV, and a DVD player. Sandra's prescription bottles were missing. Seacrest also pointed to the fact that a bloody fingerprint found on a safe in Jim's closet was never collected as evidence or tested. If Sandra had attacked Jim, wouldn't her DNA be found under his fingernails and vice versa? Seacrest called a DNA consultant to testify who said that neither Sandra nor Jim had the other's DNA under their fingernails. The only DNA found under Jim's nails was his own. There were also no visible scratches or bruises photographed on Sandra's arms or hands by crime scene investigators. Also, Seacrest argued, if Sandra had staged a home invasion and then tried to clean herself up, wouldn't chemical tests taken at the house show that there were cleaning solutions used in the sink or shower? The defense also pointed to Sandra's physical condition. She was 53 years old, 5'4", and had a litany of health problems. She had rheumatoid arthritis, a double hip replacement, and she sometimes even walked with a cane. One of the first witnesses for the defense was one of the lead detectives in the case, Sean Carrizal. Carrizal had since reportedly been forced to resign from his job after it was discovered that he had allegedly backdated search warrants. Carrizal testified that 6 days after the murder, they received a report from a television reporter who said they had noticed a suspicious neighbor who was acting strange at the scene. A neighbor who Carrizal said had been arrested for theft and was freed on bail just 2 days prior to the murder. Carrizal told the jury he went to the neighbor's home to question him, but he wasn't home, so he left him a business card, and then never heard from him or followed up on that again. A former homicide detective with the Houston Police Department also testified on behalf of the defense, essentially telling the jury that there were many flaws with the entire investigation. For starters, what could have been important witnesses were never interviewed. Potential pieces of evidence were never tested, like that bloodied handle on the safe in the master bedroom closet. And then there was unidentified male DNA found in the house, according to the defense, including on the dresser drawer handles in the master bedroom, the same drawers that had been pulled open. And remember that backpack that Sandra's daughter Liz found in the garage? Not only was there a gaming system inside, but jewelry that belonged to Sandra. The defense surmised that perhaps the intruder had dropped it as they escaped. Multiple family friends testified about Sandra and Jim's relationship, that they appeared to be happy and there was no sign of any financial issues. A digital forensics analyst examined their computers and phones and found no evidence of any affairs or anything else that was suspicious. After all that, however, a crime scene and blood spatter expert was called to refute Sandra's defense. The expert testified that there was no home invasion because there were no signs of forced entry. Dresser drawers and their contents weren't scattered throughout the bedroom. And in her opinion, it appeared the whole crime scene was staged. As for the blood, the expert agreed with the medical examiner that the murder took place in Jim's closet based on the blood patterns and the large amounts of blood inside. She agreed that Jim was trying to defend himself when he fell backwards, hit his head on a rod, and fell to the floor. Based on her review of the evidence, the expert agreed with Barnett. Sandra killed her husband. And so did the jury. After 8 hours of deliberations that spanned 2 days, the jury of 8 men and 4 women found Sandra guilty of murder. She was sentenced to 27 years in prison. Sandra shrieked and nearly collapsed in her chair at the defense table when the judge read the verdict. Sandra's supporters in the courtroom were equally shocked. After weeks of promising her that everything would be fine, Sandra was now being let out of the courtroom by a sheriff's deputy. Before she was let out the door, she stopped and gave her daughter Liz a final hug. Sandra was eventually taken to the William P. Hobby Unit, an all-women's prison lost in the cattle and barbed wire fences of Marlin, Texas, a sleepy town 30 minutes southeast of Waco. She was now 59. The jury foreman spoke to KHOU 11 and said he went back and forth on guilt or innocence throughout the entire trial. But what Colleen Barnett, the prosecutor, said made sense to him. He said what brought those jurors who believed Sandra was not guilty over to the guilty side was the police interrogation, which he said they watched again during their deliberations. A month after the verdict, Sandra's lawyer, George Secrest, filed a motion for a new trial, detailing in an 88-page brief how Sandra was convicted based on investigators who immediately honed in on her as the lead suspect and who conducted an inept investigation. the motion was denied. Sandra has continued to fight her conviction, though with little success thus far. A Texas appeals court has twice rejected her claims that she was convicted on insufficient evidence to support a conviction. She did receive some good news, however, in December 2018. Famed attorney Kathleen Zellner, of the popular Netflix series Making a Murderer, and from the Ryan Ferguson case, signed on to her legal team. Zellner hasn't spoken publicly about Sandra's case, other than a statement to a Houston TV station in which she said, quote, "We have been working for months evaluating and doing DNA testing, which we believe will ultimately exonerate Sandra Melgar. We firmly believe in her innocence, and we are gathering new evidence, which we believe will clearly prove her innocence." Sandra is currently serving out her sentence in the Carol Young Complex, a medical prison located in Dickinson, Texas, near Galveston. Her health worsened in the Hobby unit as the prison doctors struggled to correctly dose her medication. She has reportedly suffered at least 2 seizures since she was convicted. The Hobby unit also doesn't have air conditioning, leaving Sandra and the other prisoners to rely on fans to circulate the warm Texas air. Sandra petitioned the Texas Department of Criminal Justice for the move to the Carol Young unit, which has air conditioning and is more readily equipped to treat her conditions. George Seacrest, her attorney, has filed another appeal with the Texas Court of Criminal Appeals, the state's highest criminal appeals court, hoping the court will grant her freedom. He expects the process to take a year or more. So far, Sandra has served 3 years of her 27-year sentence. She's not eligible for parole until February 2031, when she'll be 71 years old. In her only interview from prison in 2018, Sandra told KHOU 11 that she didn't kill her husband.
You say you blacked out at the moment your husband was being murdered. But people watching might think, that sounds so convenient.
Yeah, it's not a blackout. I have seizures. And I had a lump on my head, so I was hit. And then I went into a seizure, more than likely. I mean, no one was there to actually see it, but that's how it felt like when I woke up.
Sandra said she wishes she knew who the real killer was because it could free her from a life locked away. She called the years since Jim died a nightmare, and that as of now, she dreams of her freedom. And that's all for this episode. As always, I'd love to know what you think about this case. Let me know by joining the conversation on Instagram at CourtJunkie, by tweeting me at CourtJunkiePod, or by emailing me at podcast@CourtJunkie.com. Today's episode was researched and written by Matt Kaiser, with a few additions by me. Matt is a freelance reporter who covered the Sandra Melgar case for a local news station. He's also the host and producer of that station's long-form podcast about the case, which was season 2 of Missing Pieces. So if you're interested in this case and want to learn even more about it, be sure to check that out. You can also follow Matt on Twitter at @ByMattKaiser. If you'd like to hear these episodes ad-free and check out additional Court Junkie bonus content, head on over to courtjunkie.com/support, which will redirect you to my Patreon page. And lastly, please subscribe to my YouTube channel, where I've been releasing some behind-the-scenes videos. The first episode of Sidebar, which is a monthly podcast I'm recording with a friend of mine, where we discuss Court Junkie cases as well as other true crime news, is up on there too. So be sure to subscribe at youtube.com/courtjunkie. And that's all for me. Thanks again for listening. Until next time. One of the sponsors of today's episode is The Jordan Harbinger Show, which is a podcast you really should be listening to. And I know that every day somebody tells you that you just have to listen to some podcast and then you nod and say sure, and then you never listen to it. Well, don't let that happen here. Jordan's show, which Apple named one of its best of 2018, is aimed at making you a better informed, more critical thinker, so you can get a sense of how the world actually works and come to your own conclusions about what's happening, even inside your own brain. Each episode is a conversation with a different fascinating guest, and when I say that there's something for everyone here, I really mean it. In one episode, Jordan talks to a hostage negotiator from the FBI, who offers techniques on how to get people to like and trust you. And another episode tells the story of a cinematographer who discovered a lost city in the jungle and made one of the most important archaeological finds of the century. Two other episodes I think you court junkies will love is his conversation with Laura Nyreiter about the anatomy of a false confession and the one with Larry Lawton, from jewel thief to honorary cop. I really enjoy this show, and I think you will as well. Search for The Jordan Harbinger Show. That's H-A-R-B as in boy, I-N as in Nancy, G-E-R, on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you listen to podcasts.
Hi, I'm Christy, an Australian who's called Canada home for more than a decade, and I'm also the host and producer of Canadian True Crime. Join me for an immersive deep dive into some of the most thought-provoking and often heartbreaking true crime cases in Canada. Using facts curated from court documents and news archives, I take you through each story from beginning to end, with a look at the way the media covered the crime and the impact it had on the community. You can find Canadian True Crime on Apple Podcasts, your favourite podcast app, or visit canadiantruecrime.ca.